Coming to you from the Forge of Freedom studio in the heart of America, a podcast dedicated to preserving freedom and inspiring personal success. Freedom is born and lives through you, the individual, and it dies in the shadows of tyranny, motivating our listeners to become well-rounded, freedom-minded people with the body of an athlete, the mind of a stoic, and the spirit of a warrior. The Tree of Liberty lives on through you, the Forge of Freedom. And now here's your host, Alex Uli.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Forge of Freedom podcast. I'm your host, Alex Uli, and this is episode 32 of the Forge of Freedom. Today, I'm joined by Donald Rainwater. He's here to discuss his candidacy for governor of Indiana in 2024. Mr. Rainwater, thanks for joining the show.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. Yeah.
So I think to start out, Mr. Rainwater, if you would just tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're running for governor of Indiana.
Well, Alex, first of all, I am a lifelong Hoosier. I was born on the east side of Indianapolis, graduated from Warren Central High School in 1981. Spent 8 years in the United States Navy as an enlisted man. Got out of the Navy, got involved in teaching computer and business classes. Then eventually got into software development. Have been a software developer for about the last 25 years. And about the last 5 or 6 years, I've been in software development management, project management. And of course, in 2016, I got frustrated with what I felt was an insult to Hoosier citizens' intelligence. If you remember back then, they were, as they often do, talking about the cigarette tax and increasing the cigarette tax. And they said that they wanted to increase the cigarette tax by $2 in order to fund the roads and encourage people to stop smoking. And as I was driving back and forth to work, hearing these commercials and hearing state legislators talk about the benefits of increasing the cigarette tax so that they could raise more road funding with the new tax and encourage people to stop smoking, I asked myself a serious question. How in the world do they think that we're stupid enough to think you can do both simultaneously? If you raise money for the roads with this tax, that's because people are smoking. And if people stop smoking, you won't have money for the roads. So I got really frustrated with the inconsistencies of our government officials. And I decided it was time to get involved. One of the things that I felt was really important was that I needed to find a political party that I felt matched my particular political values. And growing up, I had basically gone to church every time the doors opened. So I got the, what we called back in the 80s, the religious right perspective on politics. But my father was a 41-year employee of Ford Motor Company and therefore a UAW member. So I also got the blue-collar union worker perspective on politics. And so as I looked around and I looked for somewhere where I felt that I could identify with not somebody's propaganda, but some real honest values. We hear people all the time talk about, who's your values? Well, I can say the people that like to tout that don't really govern that way. And so I couldn't hang my hat with the Republican Party or the Democrat Party. And so as I looked around, I looked at things like the Constitution Party, the Libertarian Party, and I felt like the Libertarian Party most closely resembled what I believe the Constitution and the founders that wrote that Constitution were trying to portray. The idea that government is supposed to be extremely limited to the purpose, as Thomas Jefferson put it, to secure these rights. And he was talking about our unalienable rights. And so government's job is to secure our rights and really not much else. Government shouldn't be, in my opinion, my big brother or my surrogate mom. They most certainly don't need to protect me from myself, nor do I want them to. So as I looked around, the Libertarian Party really, I believe, embodied and still embodies those values. So that kind of brought me into the Libertarian Party. I started out in 2016. I ran for state senate against Luke Kenley. Many people know that who State Senator Luke Kenley is. It was funny. At one point, he looked at me during a League of Women Voters forum and told me that he was the most libertarian of the representatives down at the state of Indiana. And I said, "And sir, that's why I'm running."
You didn't need because a better reason to run than that, I don't think.
No, I don't think so. Because here again, and there are a lot of folks that hang their hat on the Republican Party here in Indiana, and they will call themselves libertarian, but they will support a party that continues to raise taxes unabashedly. And so, you know, I feel like we as citizens need to get more involved in our government again. We've become passive observers of government when it's supposed to be a government of, by, and for we the people. So I got involved. I've run for office several times. As you mentioned, I ran for governor in 2020. I'm running again in 2024. Someone asked me in an interview a couple of weeks ago, why run again? And I said, well, to be very honest with you, I look around and the people who've declared don't impress me. I don't think they have any interest in representing the citizens of the state of Indiana. Somebody has to stand up and say, I'm for the people who have to sit down on a daily basis and decide between gas for the car, food in the refrigerator, clothes on their kids' backs. And these people that are running our state today, they don't make those decisions. They don't have to. They're insulated from reality. And that's why we're in the situation we're in.
Well, I certainly appreciate your sense of a duty to serve. Like you said, it's supposed to be a government of, by, and for the people. And so many in your cigarette tax example is a great example of this. Republicans and Democrats, it seems like all they talk about on each side is how can we grow government, just in different ways. Democrats want to grow government in different ways than Republicans, but in general, they both want to grow government. And in reality, government needs to get out of the way. And I think, and I'm interested to see what you think about this. I think that's what's so refreshing about libertarianism, libertarianism with a small L, and the Libertarian Party with a big L, is that they have certain principles and values that about non-aggression, about limited government, and Absolutely. They start with those principles and analyze problems from that set of principles. Whereas with Democrats and Republicans, it seems like so often they're just throwing darts at a dartboard and seeing, you know, let's see what voters what we think voters want and see if we can try to buy some votes or promise, make some promises that get us some votes with no real principles, no real values to drive and guide their decision making.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, and I had a local government employee. This was not even somebody who was elected, but this was actually the chief of staff for the mayor of Westfield, Indiana, several years ago, not the current chief of staff, but this gentleman told a group of people, look, they give us a big pot of money and we just have to spend it. And that to me is the pervasive attitude of, as you said, both the Republican Party and the Democrat Party here in the state of Indiana. And it's local, it's county, it's state, and of course we know it's federal as well. The idea is they never met a problem that they weren't willing to throw money at, because it's not their money, it's our money. And this is one of the things that I'm very passionate about is education in Indiana. I am, to be very honest, a proponent of pulling as many of our children out of public schools or government schools. I don't like to call them public schools. They're government schools. We need to get people to pull their kids out of schools, and if they can homeschool them, homeschool them. If we need to, I think we should innovate and provide opportunities for communities to come together and create hybrid schools, co-op schools. There's lots of different terms. Provide a way for parents who feel like they're, and I'm going to use the word trapped. You know, government likes to create and breed dependency. And nowhere is dependency pushed on the citizenry more than with government education. There are thousands upon thousands of Hoosiers who would love to get their kids out of government schools, but they don't feel like there's any way that they can make that work, make that happen. But we're never going to fix what's wrong with government education until we pull enough children out of it that they go, oh man, we better do something to fix this. Yeah. We just heard both the governor and the state representatives, the General Assembly, brag that they have made unprecedented investments in education in the most recent biennial budget. Now, if you had a business that was about to go bankrupt and you knew that there was no way that you could save that business, would you make unprecedented investments in that business? I wouldn't. And I certainly wouldn't let you take money from me to invest in that business. Yet we have an education system that is failing to the point that the governor says we have over 100,000 high-paying technical jobs that are going unfilled in Indiana because Hoosiers are not educated well enough to fill those jobs. And we don't stop to think that the guy who's complaining that we're not educated well enough is the man who is responsible for education in Indiana. The Indiana General Assembly took an elected position, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, and converted it to a governor appointment. We now have an appointed Secretary of Education. She's been on the job for almost 3 years now, and we still hear about how bad education is in the state of Indiana. Well, whose fault is it? It's the Indiana GOP's fault. They control the legislature, who controls the money. They control the governor's office. They control the Indiana Department of Education. They have all this control, but they can't fix it. But they're willing to throw an extra $1.5 billion into the new state budget. That's their answer for everything, Alex. There's a problem. Let's throw more of the citizens' money at it, because we're not going to fix it, but at least we can grease the skids for our buddies who are going to turn around and give that some of that money back to us in campaign donations. Yeah. It's a massive money laundering scheme, in my opinion. And if our state government were a private corporation, the board of directors and the CEO would be under indictment. But because it's government, not only do they let themselves get away with it, but we, the citizens, let them get away with it. And that's part of the problem.
Yeah, you're exactly right. They find a problem and they say, how can we throw money at this so that our interested voters, our interested cohorts get some money and we get their vote. It reminds me, well, first of all, with your point about education, when you say pull kids from school, I think maybe that hits some people's ears a little harshly, right? But we wouldn't be physically pulling them from the schools. I think the way to do it, right, is to allow a system that encourages competition and puts the money
absolutely
in the hands of the families so that they can choose to pull their child from the school that's underperforming and take them to a place that outperforms, that does a better, that educates their child, that teaches their child the values that are consistent with their values, and teaches them how to lead and how to be entrepreneurial and
absolutely
seek out knowledge and information. Is that
you're absolutely right. Now I know that the current buzzwords are universal school choice. And I'm a huge proponent for universal school choice if it's done correctly. And by that, I mean this. In the state of Indiana, if you are fortunate enough to qualify for a voucher, which they've expanded the qualifications so more people can get vouchers now, which on the surface sounds great. But here's the problem. You talk about competition, and I agree with you 100%. We need new innovative school opportunities for children. Every child is unique. Every child has different learning abilities, different things that make them unique. And a one-size-fits-all education program does not work for anybody. But here's the thing that a lot of citizens don't know, and that I think makes a big, big difference. The current voucher system, you can only take a voucher to a state-accredited public, charter, or private school, which means that school must meet all of the regulatory requirements that the state dictates. Pardon me.
Which
stifles. I want to see, absolutely. Right. I want to see a universal school choice program in Indiana where if you and people in your community come together and create a school that you say, we don't want state accreditation. We don't want any accreditation, or we want to get privately accredited. I'm a huge believer in private accreditation. We need to be able to guarantee citizens of the state of Indiana that if they find an educational opportunity for their child that fits their child and fits their family and their family's values and the things that the parents want their child to learn, that they should be able to take one of those vouchers if they qualify for it and take that and have that child go to whatever school they choose, whether the government likes it or not. You know, one of the things that I found out in 2020 that I didn't know, now I'm a homeschool parent. I was not always a homeschool parent, but we are now. One of the things I didn't know was that there are a lot of homeschool parents that when you start trying to talk about the fact that every parent should be able to get that funding for their child to go wherever they want to, including homeschool, those parents get very upset. We don't want any of the money. Why don't they want the money? They paid into it. They get taxed just like everybody else, but they don't want it because they fear government interference. And they know that as a homeschool parent, if I don't take any government money, I don't have to worry about the government interfering. They shouldn't have that fear. There should be no this idea that because we all pay taxes and something is paid for by taxes, that the government should have oversight of that thing, that's backward. Government should not be overseeing the citizens. Citizens should be overseeing the government.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
And that is a tremendous problem that we have in Indiana.
Yeah, the children aren't the children of the government. They are the Absolutely. Parents' children. And this money with strings attached treats the children like the children are the government's children. And that's just not right. the case. It's never the case. And to your earlier point, too, I mean, there are charts I've seen. I think it was Daniel Mitchell. He writes for the Foundation for Economic Education. I'm not sure if you're familiar with fee.org, but they have some charts that show the educational performance over the last 20, 30 years, several decades, and the spending that's gone into education. And the performance right. is flat or down, and the spending has skyrocketed. And that's Absolutely. Just that is the product of a system where there is no incentive to produce a product, where there's no a quality product, where there's no competition. Because if you're going to get the right. money, no matter what, there is no incentive to improve. And that's exactly what happens. And yeah. I think that's detrimental to our children and to society as a whole to have that sort of system. And like you said, every child has different skills, different aptitudes. Each family has different values. They should be able to choose how they want to educate their child. You agree right. with that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. One thing I'd like to touch on, I know we talked a little bit of how you got into the Libertarian Party, primarily, it sounds like back in 2016. Could you talk yep. a little bit about what are the values that sort of guide your libertarian perspective? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Again, I think that the baseline is first of all, the non-aggression principle. And we talk about as libertarians, the idea that good ideas don't require force, right? If it's a good idea, we're all going to look at each other and go, wow, that's a great idea. Let's do that. And, you know, such as, for example, with property taxes, one of my big problems with property taxes is asset forfeiture. I don't believe that government should have the right, which I don't think government has the right, to take your property if you fail to pay a tax. As a matter of fact, in our current system, We don't own our property. The government does. We're just renting it by paying a semi-annual rental payment.
Yeah,
because if we stop paying the rent, that's right, they take the property from you.
Yeah. That was an issue that I saw.
Go ahead.
Where conservative, you talked about some of the inconsistencies that you noticed in both parties. That's one area where I think conservatives, I was like you, I grew up, I was mostly conservative in my views. I grew up in church. My grandfather actually worked for Ford for 4 decades.
Okay.
I have had a lot of the same sort of preconceived notions about politics when I was young or a young adult. But I noticed these inconsistencies in both parties. Like how is a property tax okay when the government can take it if you don't pay it? Then it's not property at all. How can, if you believe in the idea of self-ownership like libertarians do, how can conservatives say we can tell you what you're going to put in your own body? We can tax things like cigarettes. We can criminalize things like marijuana and other drugs.
Right.
And the list goes on and on. And of course, Democrats and liberals have the same sorts of problems with their approach. Sorry to interrupt, but
you're fine.
Non-aggression and sort of the principles that guide and inform your libertarian approach. You want to say just a little bit more about that?
Yeah. I think that and a lot of libertarians will quote a lot of the economists as a basis for their libertarian thought. I really go back to the founding documents of our nation. I'm constantly quoting the Declaration of Independence, reminding people that, government is only supposed to do one thing, and that's secure your individual rights. Your rights are paramount.
And when you say rights, I think this is a point where a lot of people get confused. When you say rights, you mean a right to be free from interference.
Absolutely.
Your liberty and your property, not a positive right. There is no right to health care. That's a misnomer, right? That's a positive right. That creates an obligation on somebody else, creates a duty on somebody else to provide you with something, right?
And I'll tell you the way that, because you bring that up, and that's something that I've had conversation with people before. Mm-hmm. Because when the term right to health care is, here again, I think a red herring. Because when people have used that the wrong way, what they're referring to is, I have a right to have somebody pay for my health care. And that's healthcare coverage. And I tell people all the time, I absolutely have the right to determine my own healthcare. I'll figure out what doctor I'm going to, when I'm going to the doctor, what treatment I will let or not let the doctor do. I will determine how I pay for it. Those are my rights, not the government's. The government doesn't have rights. Corporations, in my opinion, don't have rights. Individuals have rights. Individuals have the right to buy ownership equity in a corporation. But the corporation itself, according to my Declaration of Independence and my Constitution, both my federal constitution and my state constitution, business entities don't have rights. People have rights. And government's job is to protect those unalienable. And I love the word unalienable, and I get a kick out of it because people will say, you mean inalienable? And I go, well, originally the word was unalienable. And it means that it's not only something that can't be taken away from you, but it actually also infers that you can't give it away. I can't give away my rights. I can decide to let somebody infringe on them, but they're still mine. And if I voluntarily allow you to infringe on my rights for a year, I still have the natural right to enforce my rights, even though I voluntarily allow you to infringe on them. And I think that's a wonderful thing that I wish more people, more citizens understood. Government doesn't give us rights. And it doesn't matter in what embodiment you put the creator that Thomas Jefferson referenced in the Declaration of Independence. But government was not the creator. Government did not endow upon us our rights. Therefore, government cannot tell us what our rights are and what they aren't. And I think that here again, the Ninth and Tenth Amendment are so important for that very reason. Because the founders of our nation wanted us to know government can only do what we put in this document. Everything else is on the states and the people, and that the people retain their own rights, not just the ones written in here, but whatever rights. And so that's why whatever somebody says, well, you know, the right to health care. Well, I do have the right to determine my own health care. I don't have the right to demand that you give me health care or that you pay for my health care, because that's an infringement on your rights. Yep. Because what it all really boils down to, and I say this tongue in cheek, but I am serious about the concept. Liberty and libertarianism is the ability for me to be as stupid as I want to be, as long as I don't hurt you or take your stuff. If I want to go out and play in front of a semi-tractor trailer coming 60 miles an hour down the interstate, I'm responsible for the outcome of that, as long as I don't damage his truck.
Yeah, that's right.
But see, that to me is the foundation of libertarianism. I'm responsible for me. You're responsible for you. If I need help and you want to voluntarily help me, that's a private transaction between you and me. The government has no place in it. And that goes for, you've got a chicken that lays eggs. I've got a cow that gives milk. We trade milk for eggs. The government can suck both.
Yep.
It's none of their business. Yep. They don't have a right to any part of our transaction. And that's where we've gone wrong. Because, yes, we need to have some way of creating certain shared services. But taxation isn't the right way, and the way it's being done isn't working, because if you look around, they keep raising gasoline excise tax, they raise this tax, that tax, they've got fees for your annual vehicle registration, which I think should be abolished. All this money coming in, and the roads are still awful.
Yeah, that's a great point. And your example about the chicken and the milk, I think the government wants a piece of that, and they're always trying to find new ways to get a piece of private transactions.
Right.
And we need a government that says, no, we're going to let people freely exchange goods, ideas on a marketplace, because that's how we create a free and prosperous world. Government
right.
gets out of the way. And I
absolutely
love your point, too, about the unalienability of our rights, because whether or not you believe in God, those rights are part of our human condition. You can't separate those from us
right.
as people. And I think that's government is always trying to separate us from our rights, but they are part of our condition, our existence as humans.
Right.
And those
Absolutely.
rights, life, liberty, property, the government doesn't give us, they're meant to secure.
Yes.
Yep.
Well, and I like to always remind people that those rights, you know, include life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness as defined by you, not them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. It's a great point. And you mentioned too, the Ninth and Tenth Amendment. I think a lot of people don't know what those say or what those are. You hear a lot about the First and the Second and the Fourth, and sometimes the Seventh, Sixth, Seventh, Eighth, but
right.
almost never the Ninth and Tenth. And I think maybe there's a reason for that, because it restrains or limits political power. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I think that those are two amendments that have so much power that government doesn't want us to think about them. One of the things that I talked about during the 2020 election was the fact that, Governor Holcomb refuses to entertain the decriminalization and legalization of cannabis because he says that until the federal government decriminalizes and legalizes it, the states can't. And I've said, and I would say this about anything, where we as a state won't do something because the federal government says we can't, I say that the governor of the state of Indiana should take the Ninth Amendment in one hand, the Tenth Amendment in the other, and say, now, get back, because we're the state of Indiana, and based on these two pillars, we will do whatever we want to do unless you were given the power in the Constitution. And I believe that we've allowed... I use the example that the federal government is supposed to be fenced in by the 50 states, and that the 50 states have just kind of laid down so that the federal government has just wandered all over the place. And until we prop the 50 states back up and get the federal government back in its limits, we're not going to be able to fix things.
That's a great point. And you've seen, I think, Governor Holcomb's position with respect to marijuana is just, like you said, just sort of laying down. It's allowed the federal government to sort of emasculate the states and state
Absolutely.
Power and state sovereignty. And the Ninth, and for those who don't know, if it's okay with you, Mr.
Absolutely.
Rainwater, I'll share the Ninth and Tenth Amendment here. I've got it in front of me. The Ninth Amendment just says the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So just because the Second Amendment says we have a right to keep and bear arms, it doesn't mean we don't have other rights. Just because it says we have a right to free speech doesn't mean we don't have other rights. Am I reading that correctly? Is that your...
That's the way I interpret it.
Yep.
And obviously... I didn't go to law school, so you know you're interpreting it correctly, because if I can figure it out, anybody can. And I tell people that all the time. I'm not a constitutional scholar. I don't have years of adjudicate. I just use common sense. You know, they taught me to read when I was in kindergarten in the first grade. Back when you could still learn to read in a public school. And, it's just common sense. Because if you listen to what you just read, it's hey, just because we've got this stuff here doesn't mean you don't have other rights. And they are your rights.
Well, then
I'm sure you were going to read the 10th as well, because I think it's equally as powerful.
It is. And I think... But here's the thing. I am an attorney. I did go to law school, but the Ninth and Tenth Amendment were never mentioned in law school. And
isn't that amazing?
Yeah. The Second Amendment, never mentioned. And that just sort of shows you the degradation and sort of the legal scholarship that's out mm-hmm. there today. And the other thing is that as an attorney, I'm not sure if that's an asset or a curse in terms of common sense, because you've probably heard the saying, some variation of it, that if you put two attorneys in a room, you'll get five different opinions.
I understand.
Yeah. So, so anyway, so the 10th Amendment says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. So
yeah,
very powerful language in both of these amendments, which is why the federal government and government in general likes to ignore them, in my mind.
Well, and that's one of the things, and you can kind of relate to this, I'm sure, from a legal perspective. That's why the Commerce Clause is such a frustration for me. Because from a perspective of the idea that the Commerce Clause was written before the 9th and 10th Amendments were written. And so the 9th and 10th Amendments were clarifications that you can't stray too far out into the lunatic fringe, if you will, with your interpretation of things like the Commerce Clause. Yet that's exactly what we've let the federal government do.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly what happened. So with all this in mind, we've talked about non-aggression and sort of the role of government and your approach to that from a libertarian perspective. And we've touched on some tax issues. You want to talk a little bit more about some other tax issues that you'd like to address as governor?
Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, 9 states have no state income tax. Indiana should be number 10. We need to do away the idea that government has an equity position in your earnings is appalling to me. I don't believe there should be an income tax, federal or state, but obviously as governor of the state of Indiana, my bully pulpit is within the state, so we talk about the state income tax. I would abolish it. I would do away with it, not study it for a couple of years, not reduce it slowly down to 3% from 3.2%. I would get rid of it. Hoosiers need their earnings, and they need to decide where their money goes. The property tax, if it were up to me, we'd abolish it too, but it's been pointed out to me by lots of people that, oh, we can't see what, how would we pay for everything that the government needs to do? The local governments, the schools, why in the world we want to pay for failing schools? I don't know, but you know, people are worried about how would we pay for the schools? How would we pay for the police and fire? In my world, I pay utility bills. I would be okay if I got a utility bill for police and fire where they had a budget that they figured out, and then we figured out a way to make sure that every house in the area contributed to paying for that budget. Not just, we're going to take as much money as we can get out of you, then we're going to figure out how to spend it. That's backward. So I would abolish the income tax, but since we can't abolish the property tax, I think the first thing we need to do is fix the red herring that is the 1% cap. Because nothing's capped when an assessor can reassess your property every year and keep raising your taxes. It should be a maximum of 1% of the purchase price of your property. That way you know it never goes up. You always know what it is because you paid, let's say you paid $325,000 for your home. You know that you're going to pay 1% every year, $325,000, that would at least stop this continual increase.
The assessment is the corollary to inflation when it comes to property tax.
Yeah, and I think that's ridiculous. Yeah. I would also say that if in order for us to get rid of asset forfeiture, that we have a 7% sales tax in Indiana. So let's cap the property tax you pay at 7%, period. So when you close on your house, a lot of people pay a realtor a 7% realty fee when they sell. Well, when you sell the house, you pay, or I'm sorry, when you buy the house, you pay 7% at closing, you're done. If you want to apportion that out for 7 years, 1% a year, that's fine. After the seventh year, you're done. We eliminate this thing where you pay for 30 years on a home, you pay off your mortgage, and you're still paying property taxes when you're on a fixed income. That's just wrong. I mean, it's not just unethical that the government does it. It's immoral. Mm-hmm. And so these are some ideas that I've thrown out. Really to get some conversation started instead of this, well, you know, we don't know what to do. Another, you know, kick the can down the road. They're going to study property taxes for another 2 years. You know, let's do some common sense stuff. And when people say, whoa, but how would we pay for, you know what? A lot of what we are paying for today, we don't need to.
Yeah.
And we could cut state spending significantly without touching anything that people refer to as entitlements, any of the promises state government has made to people. We wouldn't even have to touch that stuff. All we need to do is focus on process improvement and what I call administrative reform within state government. There is so much waste and abuse. Contracts by vendors. Vendors are allowed to milk a contract, bleed money out of the state of Indiana, thereby the taxpayers, with almost no repercussions whatsoever. It's almost as if the contracts are written so that they can. But of course, our government would never do such a thing. But that I believe that there is millions, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of savings just in bringing state processes out of the 1970s. You know, we're in 2023. There are better ways to do things. And frankly, when people start saying, well, are you talking about cutting jobs? There are state employees. Hey, as we talked about earlier, there are 100,000 or more high-paying jobs that corporations can't fill in Indiana because we don't have the people. Let's take these state employees and train them up and transition them into these high-paying jobs. They would probably be tickled to death to increase their salary by 1.5, 2 times, and get out of the, I don't know if you've ever been in Indiana Government Center North or South.
I have.
It's not the best working environment that I've ever been in.
Right.
So, you know, there, again, there's common sense. There are ways that we can cut government spending without saying, oh, you're going to hurt grandma because you're going to take away her Medicare or her Medicaid, or, you know, you're going to hurt this poor unemployed guy over here because you're going to take away his unemployment. First of all, Indiana's unemployment system is a joke. And there are very few people who can put food on the table and keep the lights on when they're unemployed based on unemployment insurance. There's got to be a better way here again, private unemployment insurance, where you can negotiate with an insurance company to provide a policy that fits your needs if you lose your job. I think that makes a lot of sense, because what we have with the state of Indiana is just a joke.
Yeah. Well, and that's a great point. And there are so many ways. If we talked about education, you talked about police and fire, you talked about unemployment. If you just open up these things to a competitive process, to a competitive market, not Absolutely. Only would you get better service, you would get the service for far less money.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think that's true with all these things. And one thing about the, going back to a point you were making about education reform and the underperformance, I'm putting it lightly, of government schools, is that
the abject failure is the way I like this.
That's a more accurate way to put it. is that so much of it, it's like, oh, you don't care about teachers, because the teachers' union has such a stranglehold on the conversation around education reform. But the fact is that if there were competition, teachers could find better jobs that actually
Absolutely.
Fulfill the purpose that they got into teaching for, and that's to teach children and to help them grow into adults. And I think teachers would be far more fulfilled, would have a much more positive and encouraging work environment if they worked within a competitive system.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
And I think most teachers would agree with you too.
Yeah.
And the people who wouldn't agree with you probably aren't teachers. They're just people who get a paycheck for showing up at a school somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing you mentioned about the, just tell a quick story, a personal experience I had just this last weekend, actually. I went to a public meeting about a sewer project. Some entities are trying to develop a new sewer project. It involves a fair amount of corporate welfare, and it's helping a local municipality expand and create a bigger tax base. That's a lot of the incentive behind the project, but it's funded largely by grant money, other people's money, taxpayer money
right.
from the federal government that was allocated through, I think it was ARP funds, American Recovery Plan funds.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I like to call those COVID giveaways.
The COVID giveaways. That's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. But it's going to cost over $1 million to come up with the plan. And you've got these engineering firms lining up to line their pockets to create the plan.
Absolutely.
And of course, the project may never happen. So
right.
That's exactly what you're talking about in terms of all this waste that happens with government projects. Just huge amounts of waste.
Absolutely.
All right, so we've talked about education reform, tax reform, administrative reform, and I certainly appreciate your comments about the income tax and property tax. I think the government has no business in the equity of the product of your labor or
right.
your property. And let's make property real property, not just rented property, right?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Are there any other issues that you'd like to point out, or any challenges that you think Indiana is facing that you'd like to draw attention to?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I think that there are dozens of things that don't get the attention they deserve. Professional licensing. If you look at there was a story in the Indianapolis Star. It almost nauseates me to read it, but I read it to try to stay up on what at least they are willing to report is going on. They were talking about the length of time that nurses and doctors are waiting to get credentialed in the state of Indiana. And here again, we hear that we have a shortage of medical providers, yet people apply for licenses in the state of Indiana and they wait for months with no response. This is bad government. My campaign slogan is better government, not bigger government. And we have to look at some of this stuff. I think it's ridiculous. If I want to go to a barber that's not licensed, then obviously if I go to a barber that's not licensed, he's not going to have to do a lot of work. But that's my choice. And if a private organization wants to license or certify a group of professionals, and I choose to go to them, that's on me. This idea that the government is smart enough and skilled enough to properly license professionals, childcare. Oh my goodness, the number of, over the last 20 years, the number of licensed, state licensed childcare facilities where children have been harmed or worse, died. Government has no business licensing anything. And we need to take a good hard look at that, and we need to fix that broken system.
Yeah, I agree with that. Licensing is terrible.
Yes.
It limits competition, once again. And I think the standards are actually lower than they would be if you had private licensing or certification.
Absolutely.
Programs. And I think it hurts the consumer because you get lower quality products. You get less of it. There's shortages, higher cost because there are shortages, and lower quality. So I think government licensing does nothing but harm.
Absolutely.
Licensing. And
I agree with you.
Yeah. Including lawyers, right? I mean, I'm an advocate that I don't think that lawyers should have to be licensed.
I don't disagree with that either.
Open up the market. So
yeah.
Okay. So occupational licensing, and I don't want to keep you too long here, Mr. Rainwater, but I'm happy to keep going if there are other issues that you'd like to raise. And
no, I mean, we could stay here all night, but I think there are some folks that need my attention elsewhere. Right. So
well, excellent.
I really appreciate the opportunity to come on the podcast and talk to you and talk to your listeners and express some of my opinions. Sure that many of them have heard a lot of my opinions before, and I hope that they will go out to www.rainwaterforindiana.com, look at the issues page, look at some stances I have on some other issues. We've got a contact link there. They can click on that, send me a message. They can sign up to volunteer. And of course, we have the all-important donate button where they can click on that. And they, you know, I tell people all the time, if you're tired of paying taxes in Indiana, instead of them taking it, voluntarily donate it to my campaign. And I'm sure you're probably familiar with the Americans for Tax Reform. They have a program they call the Taxpayer Protection Pledge. I signed that in 2020. I will sign it again in 2024. And it very clearly states that as governor of Indiana, I pledge to oppose and veto any attempt to increase taxes or create new taxes. And I firmly believe in that.
Excellent. Well, I certainly appreciate you coming on the show. I'm happy that you were able to join. I really enjoyed the conversation. Kind of in closing, if you don't mind, Could you say just, you're running for Libertarian. A lot of people say, hey, a vote for third party, for Libertarian, it's a wasted vote. Can you just say a little bit about that and why maybe that's not the right approach to this?
Well, there's two elements of that from my perspective, Alex. The first one is this. If you vote for somebody who doesn't give a plug nickel about you, your children, your home, or anything other than how much money they can extract from your bank account, that's a wasted vote. When you vote for somebody that you know is answering to their special interests, the lobbyists, the people who are making huge donations to their campaigns, and they don't care about you, that's a wasted vote. When you vote for somebody that you believe has your values and your best interest and your individual rights at heart, that can never be a wasted vote. And here's why. You vote for somebody who really believes in what you believe in and who is willing to stand up and talk about the way government should be, not the way government is. And if enough people do that, if that person doesn't win, they will scare the living daylights out of the Republicans and Democrats, and those people will be incentivized to listen to the citizens instead of ignore them, because they ignore us because we continue to vote for them. If we stop voting for them, it will scare them to death, and they'll start doing what they're supposed to do. That's my belief.
Yeah. Well, and you're not just some nobody. You got over 11% of the vote in 2020, and I think have a real opportunity here to capitalize on the Republican complacency in the state. So I wish you luck, and I hope people follow your campaign, donate to your campaign, and really spread the word.
Absolutely.
Because you're the candidate for freedom, for life, liberty, and property, and the pursuit of happiness, and your own happiness.
That's right. Right. Happiness is defined by you, not them.
That's right. All right, folks. Well, thanks again, Mr. Rainwater, for joining the show. It's rainwaterforindiana.com.
And, absolutely.
You've got a Facebook page as well. I know you're pretty active on there, so check those resources out if you have any questions about the campaign. Thanks again, Mr. Rainwater.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Alex.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Forge of Freedom. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss a future episode. For more information or to connect with Alex, you can go to forgeoffreedom.com or follow him on Twitter at Forge of Freedom. Until next time, remember, you are the Forge of Freedom.